It's Monday, April 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. North Korea claims a successful launch of a sub-based ballistic missile. South Korea disagrees.
They don't have the capacity of attacking or going to war with anyone.
We'll hear perspective from a North Korea expert. Also ahead, Afghanistan and Pakistan brace for Taliban attacks. U.S. presidential hopefuls await a decision of more voters. And the fan outpouring continues for Prince. It's all on today's International Edition. North Korea is calling its submarine-launched ballistic missile test on Saturday a great success, while South Korea has labeled it a failure. Military analysts, however, are classifying the missile launch as a successful failure. North Korea's claim, made through its state news agency, KCNA, that it now has another means by which to carry out a powerful nuclear attack, seems to exaggerate its present military capabilities. South Korea says the missile launched on Saturday traveled just 30 kilometers before it fell into the sea. That's well short of the minimum range of 300 kilometers for the medium-range ballistic missile it had tested. Commenting on North Korea's latest test, President Barack Obama said that it's clear that North Korea is actively engaged in provocative behavior. During a visit to Germany, Mr. Obama also dismissed a North Korean offer to impose a moratorium on nuclear tests if the U.S. suspends annual military drills with South Korea. Despite the continued provocations, Geir Helgesen, director of the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies at Copenhagen University, says the international consensus remains that a conciliatory approach seems to work best with North Korea.
Well, in a way, I'm a follower of the late president of South Korea, Kim Dae-jung, explaining that everything else has been tried without success. He said, we have isolated them, we have pressured them, we have tried to outmaneuver them in economic situation and whatever, and they are still there, they are still causing us a lot of problems. And then he, with his supporters, invented the so-called Sunshine Policy. And although the Sunshine Policy didn't solve the problem on the Korean Peninsula in 10 years, to some extent, I strongly disagree with colleagues saying that the Sunshine Policy was a failure. I think it was basically a success, but it was stopped too early.
We do have the continuing events in North Korea where they will set off a nuclear test or a missile or something like that. United Nations will come down with mandates and sanctions, and the international community will condemn it. How does that fit in with a conciliatory approach? It seems like these two approaches are at odds, but you almost have to go against them with a hard hand when they do something.
Maybe or maybe not. I believe that when the UN and when human rights organizations and Western governments are condemning North Korea for testing nuclear devices or missiles, they also do it for their own purpose to some extent. They are doing it to prove to their own population, their own voters, that we are strongly against this ugly dictatorship in Northeast Asia. But North Korea will not change behavior because of this kind of condemnation and pressure, even though they might talk like this and threaten people. We know that this is absolutely nonsense. They don't have the capacity of attacking or going to war with anyone. They are the weak, weak, weak part.
Both South Korea and North Korea talk about unification quite a bit, although they are coming from very different angles on that. How does the reunification affect this conversation?
Today, I'm sure that nobody in the political regime and the system of North Korea believe that their system will actually prevail and be victorious. They know they are ruling a failed system, so to speak. Their problem is how to find a way out of it without losing face and without totally losing their power and their positions. So they are searching for a way out, and they are not expecting their system to conquer the peninsula as such.
It must make the dialogue rather difficult if the North is aware that they're going to be the ones on the, quote, losing end of this, and their system is not going to survive. That has to complicate things.
Yes, I think it does. And the pressure from outside is kind of keeping the old guard in the ruling position. And it's very difficult for the younger ones to maneuver. Therefore, also, the Western world's strong pressure against North Korea is counterproductive for a reform from the inside of the country.
Geir Helgesen, director of the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies at Copenhagen University. Time now to have our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, here in the studio to talk about what's buzzing online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
North Korea, nuclear test, and President Obama. This story's got to be trending online.
Absolutely. People around the world are talking about it, and it's very interesting to see the different angles media outlets and people in different countries have taken to talk about the story. Let's begin with the United States. Bloomberg Politics tweeted, Obama says U.S. won't stop military drills, that is referring to the joint exercises in Korea's East Sea, spurning North Korea. And here's a Facebook post by NBC News from an hour ago. President Obama said Sunday he doesn't take seriously North Korea's claim that it would halt nuclear tests if the U.S. suspends military exercises with South Korea.
So the focus is on Washington's response. Mm-hmm. What's the public's reaction like?
It was more about President Obama than the U.S. policy or even Pyongyang's claim. One of the most popular replies reads, President Obama is far from perfect, but at least he's professional and classy. Other people criticized the commander-in-chief didn't take ISIS seriously either, and that took a toll on America's national security.
Well, let's move beyond the United States. What's the international reaction?
Canadian Foreign Minister Stéphane Dion tweeted, Canada calls on North Korea to cease its reckless provocations and refrain from actions which pose a threat to international peace and security. China's state-run Xinhua News Agency did not confirm the North's latest claims, but introduced a new idea by tweeting, What does North Korea vow to do should the U.S. and South Korea stage nuclear provocations against it? Now, Iran's Press TV, the first international news network from that country, also tweeted about it. It wrote, North Korea missile launches getting serious, U.S. official says. Very toned down report of that story. So that's all for me today, Jim.
All right. A great wide variety of responses. Thank you so much for that, G. She tweets for our program's account at @VOA_IE and from her own account at G. Abby Lee. I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Taliban has already made a deadly strike in its annual spring offensive, and now Pakistan has assured neighboring Afghanistan that peace talks with the Taliban will resume in a month to find a peaceful end to the Afghan conflict. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
Taliban-led insurgent violence has spiked in Afghanistan with the onset of spring, prompting fears this year could see record levels of bloodshed across the war-torn country. This week's deadly Taliban assault in Kabul that killed around 70 people and wounded hundreds more has observers concerned that Afghan urban centers could be the focus of the insurgency's fighting in 2016. The rise in violence has led to increased calls from within Afghanistan for President Ashraf Ghani's government to abandon its policy of seeking peace talks with the Taliban and instead intensify military operations against the insurgent group. But despite the pressure, visiting Afghan Minister for Refugees and Repatriation, Syed Hussain Alimi Balkhi, after a meeting with Pakistani Foreign Policy Chief Sartaj Aziz, appeared upbeat about prospects of peace talks with the anti-government forces. The Afghan minister says that Aziz assured him the Afghan peace process will resume in about a month and it will encourage nearly 3 million Afghans living in Pakistan as refugees and economic migrants to return to their homeland. Taliban leaders are believed to be sheltering and allegedly directing insurgent attacks from sanctuaries in Pakistan. Afghan officials have been urging Islamabad to bring those leaders to the negotiating table. Islamabad admits having limited influence over some insurgent groups, but says it has no control over Taliban activities inside Afghanistan. An initial round of peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban was expected to be hosted by Pakistan in early March, but the insurgent group refused to attend in a last-minute announcement. Minister Balkhi is in Pakistan to discuss problems facing the Afghan refugee population, such as harassment at the hands of local police, forced deportations, and illegal detentions during counter-terrorism crackdowns. His Pakistani counterpart, Abdul Qadir Baloch, says the visiting Afghan minister has been assured the complaints are being addressed through certain steps. He insisted that mainly Afghans living illegally as economic migrants and not the registered refugees are facing the problems. Baloch says that to address the issue, Pakistani authorities, with the help of the Afghan government, will start within a month a registration process for an estimated 1.5 million undocumented Afghans.
So it will be done soon, and hopefully once these Afghan refugees who are unregistered, they are registered and issued with Afghan documents. And we also have a record of them. And thereafter, this complaint of their being harassed or arrested or persecuted in an undesirable manner, that should come to an end. That will soon will come to an end.
Minister Baloch says that there are around 1.5 million registered Afghan refugees in the country, and he will soon submit a request to the federal cabinet to extend their stay in Pakistan until the end of 2017. The current deadline for the Afghan refugee population to legally stay in the country ends in June of this year. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Another large number of political party delegates are up for grabs this week in U.S. presidential primaries. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman stops by the studio to fill us in.
Jim, this is the last major batch of states holding primary contests. After this, there are other states, but it's sort of a slow trickle week by week. This is the real big catch for all the different candidates between now and early June. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are coming off big wins in the state of New York. And all the states that are up for grabs on Tuesday are states in the general area surrounding New York. And these are areas where traditionally candidates such as Trump and Clinton have done quite well. I'm not saying that there can't be any surprises. For instance, on the Republican side, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, his state borders Pennsylvania. And that is the biggest prize that's up for grabs on Tuesday. Polls are favoring Trump in Pennsylvania and in most of the other states, and they are also heavily favoring Hillary Clinton.
And Trump has taken the interesting tack of toning down his message this week, so to speak, at least appear a little more presidential in this last swing.
In his victory speech after the New York primary last Tuesday, in fact, he kept his remarks to about 10 minutes. And the way he did that was by leaving out all of his normal insults and hyperbole. And when you eliminate all that from Donald Trump, you get a 10-minute speech.
On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton appears to be cruising toward the nomination. Bernie Sanders does have an awful lot of delegates, but at this point, it looks like he may be mathematically eliminated.
I don't know that it's absolutely impossible for Bernie Sanders to get the nomination, but I suspect that he would have to get about 90% of the remaining delegates or some astronomical proportion similar to it. And that's simply not going to happen. There is a certain argument that with him remaining in the race, that he keeps Hillary on her toes. And indeed, she has had to address progressive themes more directly. That said, she will obviously run in November the campaign that she feels she needs to run. And I suspect that that means a pivot towards the center, much as whoever the Republican candidate is will do something similar and pivot more to the center.
We always pivot toward the Hill, Capitol Hill, that is, and the Senate side in particular, with VOA Senate correspondent Mike O'Bowman. Mike, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Jim.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
There. This is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
American pop music icon Prince was laid to rest Saturday in a private ceremony for close friends and family. The musician's publicist released a statement saying the musician was cremated and then honored in a small private ceremony, apparently at Prince's home and studio complex outside the northern city of Minneapolis, Minnesota. The publicist said the, quote, final storage of his remains will remain private. Medical examiners are still looking into what killed the 57-year-old musician, who was found dead alone at home on Thursday. Police said there were no signs of trauma on his body and no reason to suspect suicide. Prince's unexpected passing shocked millions of fans, including International Edition's David Byrd and VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee.
A shock to all of us. I do believe that he was suffering from diabetes. There was a report that he admitted that he had been suffering from epilepsy some years ago. But again, at this moment, we don't know exactly what the cause of death is. We know that foul play has been ruled out, which will lead us to believe that it was natural causes.
His catalog goes all the way back to the 1970s.
Yes.
I remember his first album, his first hit, I Want to Be Your Lover,
mm-hmm.
in high school.
Mm-hmm.
We played the grooves off of that record, and he was a phenomenal guitar player. He was a phenomenal bass player, which mm-hmm. a lot of folks don't realize. He was a composer. He could tell you if the speaker stacks were out of phase. He was, to put it lightly, a genius, a musical genius, almost the personification of funk.
Oh, absolutely. And pop, because he had that, and R&B, because he had those elements as well, and rock, because we heard a lot of rock influence in some of his latter stuff. Now, I was introduced to Prince a little later on, during the Purple Rain phase. I had the album and played it over and over again. One of my favorite songs still to this day is When Doves Cry.
Why do we scream at each other?
Prince was always ahead of his time. He was always a very provocative artist in terms of the kinds of things that he sang about, the themes, but also, like you say, musically, he was not afraid to experiment with different sounds and textures and instruments. And I remember him being the first artist that kind of brought sort of that electric sound into music, along with the more acoustic traditional sounds of the instruments that he played. And I think it's also very important, as we remember Prince, to not only remember him as a musical genius, but also to know that he was an activist. He was very, very active in terms of artists' rights. You may remember later on, I think it was sort of the 90s, when we couldn't call him Prince anymore.
Right, he became a symbol, a hieroglyph.
The artist formerly known as Prince. And this was because he was in a huge legal battle with Warner Brothers. And he was also a social activist and a civil rights activist. I mean, if you go back and listen to some of his songs, he was very much aware of what was going on in the U.S. He was also aware of some of the issues around the world, and those themes found their way into his songs as well. Another one of my all-time favorite songs is Sign of the Times. And if you listen to that song, you hear a man who was saying, listen to what is going on in inner city America. Be aware of what is happening and how this is affecting us all.
What do you think? Send us a tweet. You can send one to Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. Look for more of our coverage of the life and the death of Prince on our website, voanews.com.
We will be listening to Prince for years to come, no doubt. We're not going to be listening to International Edition for much longer, at least for this edition, because our show's coming to a close, but we'll be back again later. You can always find us at voanews.com any time of the day or night you like. Also on Twitter, follow us at VOA underscore IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. And we hope the rest of it is just absolutely great. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 25th, we observe World Malaria Day in hopes of highlighting the global effort to effectively control and eventually wipe out this terrible disease. This year's theme is End Malaria for Good. About half of the world's population, nearly 3.2 billion people, is at risk for malaria. Most cases and deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa, but Asia, Latin America, and even the Middle East are also at risk. Malaria is a deadly disease. In 2015, 214 million people became sick with malaria, and 438,000 of them died. But malaria is also preventable and curable, and there is good reason to believe that we can eliminate it altogether. This is borne out by the fact that between 2000 and 2015, when the global community intensified its efforts to control the disease, new cases among populations at risk fell by 37% globally. In that same period, malaria death rates among populations at risk fell by 60% among all age groups and by 65% among children under 5. Nonetheless, a child dies from malaria at least every 2 minutes, and hundreds of millions of people at risk of contracting malaria still do not receive the services they need. The United States, in cooperation with its many partners, including host countries, multilateral organizations, and countless others, is redoubling its efforts to prevent and treat malaria. With approval from the U.S. Congress, next year, the United States will increase the budget for the President's Malaria Initiative by $200 million. This would allow the initiative to expand its program to almost 70 million additional people at risk of malaria in Cameroon, Côte d'Ivoire, Sierra Leone, and Burkina Faso. The initiative would accelerate elimination efforts in Cambodia and Zambia, provide 13.7 million insecticide-treated nets to protect 27 million people in sub-Saharan Africa from malaria, and accelerate research, development, and evaluation of new malaria tools focused on vector control and medicines. The global malaria community stands within the reach of achieving the goals that we once thought were unimaginable, ending deaths from malaria, and then eliminating malaria from the globe, said retired Rear Admiral Tim Zimmer, the coordinator of U.S. Global Malaria Programs. it is critically important that we build on this momentum.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.